Were any of you in the energy panel? Wasn't Woolsey wonderful? Wasn't Gary Hart great? I thought Doug was good. I hoped you would speak up.
There was some girl up there.
Oh, that was some lady.
You ready, Miss Harmon?
Okay, thanks. I have the honor, and I think it's a correct way to put it, of being the co-founder of what's called the Harmon Eisner Arts Program at the Institute. And its significant first undertaking was the creation of the Artist in Residence. Our first Artist in Residence last year gave this program such energy and such grace and such charm that if we had never done another thing, it would have been considered a gigantic success. The idea of the program was to take the Institute back to its crucial roots. This began with a celebration of the arts, literally 50-odd years ago, of Goethe and music. And as the Institute has grown and developed substantial gravitas in virtually every significant policy arena you can think about, we somehow lost track of the consequence of the arts. And the purpose of the program was to make absolutely certain that we at the Institute, who do really recognize that the arts move far beyond decoration, far beyond badminton, that the arts are intrinsic to a seriously developed life and should therefore be intrinsic to a seriously developing institute. And the notion of having artists on the premises while our programs are in process was one that really speaks to the relationship of these two. That is, that the artist brings that unique poetic perspective to every issue of consequence, whether it's health or war and peace. And by participating in our programs, not only will that artist illuminate the program, but without question, will draw much of value from it. Anna DeFere Smith was a smash last year. And I tell you that we could hardly have imagined a successor to match Jesse Norman. Now, you guys know all about these two notables, and I'm not going to take any of their time to tell you of the glorious career each of them has had, each of them is building. But each of them speaks to the unique role, not just of the artist, but of the woman as artist, and we'll see and hear much of that today. Two last comments. One of my dearest friends in life died on Monday. Beverly Sills was a truly great person. She was, without question, one of the great operatic stars of all history. Those of us who knew her well knew that this was mother courage. Never on earth, ever in history, did anybody absorb so bloody much human punishment with such unimaginable, inestimable grace. Her loss, typified by the fact that she died of lung cancer and almost none of us close to her had even a whisper of it, speaks volumes about her life and her career and our possibilities. And my last comment, and I say this through my tears, my last comment is that when I had met Anna DeVere Smith, our first glorious artist in residence, we found in a curious moment that each of us shared an affection for a comment by Albert Camus to the effect that a man's life work is nothing less than this slow trek to rediscover through the arts those two or three simple but glorious images in whose presence his heart first opened. You're about to spend some time with two of those glorious images. I know your hearts will open. Emma?
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Sydney, I'm so happy to see you because I haven't seen you since I arrived this time. And speaking of hearts opening, Jamie Miller made a comment last night that I've put my heart into a couple of things that we're doing this year. And I think that Aspen is just irresistible in terms of a place where the heart opens. And I'm so happy that you and Michael Eisner and others here, Walter Isaacson, have and Kitty Boone and Jamie Miller, are putting real brain power behind reinvigorating the arts here. And I can't thank you enough for the opportunity that I had last year, and it affected me all year. And also to introduce, along with Miss Jessie Norman, Mr. Stephen Wadsworth, who is the other artist in residence. Would you please stand, Stephen? And we have also Miss Felicia Rashad, who helped us animate August Wilson last night.
Oh, it's wonderful. Wonderful.
Do you want to say anything at all about Miss Sills before we begin? I know.
Well, I would like to ask us, if you wouldn't mind, let's just give a few seconds of quietness and our thoughts about this incredible artist, this incredible human being, and our friend who's now singing in heaven. Amen.
You know, when we spoke over the weekend at Harris Hall,
uh-huh.
We talked a bit about your childhood, and I told you today I wanted to talk about your adult life more.
Yes.
However, I have to now that my favorite quote has been evoked. ask you in whose presence your heart first opened. The sort of wonderful sentiment about that quote of Camus is the notion that we go through a journey in our lives,
yes,
to come back to those mm-hmm. first openings.
Yes. I think that probably as a young child I experienced lots of moments of that kind, but I would like to share with you the first time that I ever heard the voice of Marian Anderson. A friend, next door neighbor, had a set of 78s. And one of the recordings within that group of things was the alto rhapsody of Brahms, sung by Marian Anderson. And our equipment at home didn't play 78, so I went next door to Mrs. Murphy's house to listen to this. And she put the record on, and I simply stared at the machine. And I asked her, is that just somebody singing, or is that something else? Because if you have the idea, if you have the sound of Marian Anderson's voice in your ear, I'm sure that you can understand exactly my reaction at 9 or 10 years old. And I listened to it and I said something like, this must be very important what she's singing. And of course, I didn't speak German and knew absolutely nothing about Goethe. But I felt in that moment that that was a big world out there, far beyond my singing, "Yes, Jesus loves me and Jesus wants me for a sunbeam," and all of those big numbers that were mine at the time. And it was really a heart opening and a mind opening. And I remember it as though it happened day before yesterday.
You know, let me also just say a little bit about this session. If anybody has a watch I could borrow, that would be a
I'm
great
right
thing. Shall we have it on the table?
Mm-hmm.
Because I like this room. We have our pencils and things. More a little bit like a workshop. We're going to talk a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Norman is going to play some of her music.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we'll have questions. So I think their cards have gone around so that we'll collect those in about a half an hour so mm-hmm. that we can come to some of your questions. You know,
mm-hmm.
I ran into Lance Armstrong on the street.
Oh my goodness.
Two nights ago.
Uh-huh.
And I know he spoke here yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually one of the characters I'm working on for my new play.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
In researching him,
mm-hmm.
I learned from National Geographic that he has less lactic acid than most people.
Mm.
And his heart can beat at 200 beats a minute.
Oy, oy, oy.
And so there is this. So when I'm reading all this stuff, and these are like scientists, you know,
mm-hmm.
studying him
mm-hmm.
and stuff, National Geographic, I'm thinking, well, what would have happened if Lance Armstrong had never found out that he had to be in the position for anybody to find out that he had less lactic acid? What if he was still chasing, you know, his bike with big trucks in
mm-hmm.
Texas? And so I think about you and the fact that part of your gift, your very large gift, is physical.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just say a few things about your ribs and your sinuses? And I just wonder. This is true. This
no, it's
is
absolutely
not a
true. No, I was very lucky. I use the word lucky a lot when I'm talking about myself because it's absolutely true. I was very lucky that my very first vocal professor, and I was a student at Howard University and 17 years old, was a true vocal pedagogue. This was a person who decided very early in her life that she wanted to teach singing, that she had no thoughts or wishes to be this Carolyn V. Grant. And she had no desire or wish to be on stage herself. She wanted to teach singing. And therefore, she spoke a great deal about the physiology, the anatomy of singing. And she wanted us to understand this and to take this mystery, as I said to the singing students yesterday, out of vocal production. So we understood sort of the shape of the diaphragm. We understood the xiphoid process and the way that the air is forced out of the lungs past these two little things that are vibrating that make it possible for us to speak and under control to make it possible for us to sing. And you probably can't believe this if you're not a singer yourself, but singing is a very physical responsibility. And it really requires being as healthy as one can keep oneself so that this instrument that we carry around in our throats rather than a nice box that we can put away at night can do what it needs to do. And it really is so important to not sit in a draft, to take care of our bodies, because that's where the voice lives. And we've sort of been measured to see that an opera performance, one can use as many calories as a marathon runner. Certainly, the operas that I tend to enjoy, which are the very long operas of Wagner and Berlioz and so on, but they require a lot physically. And one has to be aware of that.
And what about your ribs and your sinuses?
My ribs and my sinuses. Well, if they're doing what they're supposed to do, they should expand in this way. There should be as much expansion laterally as there is posteriorly and anteriorly. I'm sure there are doctors in here that will say, let me talk about something about which I know, and you talk about singing. But one has to be very sure that these sinuses, on which we depend so much for so much facial resonance, are clear and clean. I promise you, I live with saline solution tubes in my luggage. And when I was in somewhere, I guess China, sort of last November or something, and trying to get on a plane to go from one place to the other, and one of the security people wanted to take my saline solution away that I had in my handbag, I thought, no. You can have the lotion, you can have the eye drops, but if you take my saline solution, then I'm going back to New York. So we came to an understanding.
Do you think that different sounds make you feel different ways? I was thinking just the other day, mm-hmm. actually, in prepping for this, about mm-hmm. how one time you and I were meeting mm-hmm. to go see a play mm-hmm. in New York, and you know, it was a very crowded lobby. Mm-hmm. And I knew that you were there, and when I told you that, you said, well, I'm not going to imitate you.
Yes, asked she me, is.
You asked me if it was because you speak loudly, and it's not. It was literally that the room started to vibrate in a different way when you arrived. And so,
oh.
This is true. It's not just a compliment. And so how do you think about vocal vibrations and what they can do, what they do? You know, along those lines, you... Speaking of the doctors in the house, mm-hmm. you wanted to be a doctor.
Yes,
but
I did.
But you heal people all over the world. I mean,
oh, thank you.
What are these vibrations that the voice has, and what can the voice do?
Well, not only the human voice, but instrumental music as well has been shown to have healing powers. One of the reasons when I was in Taiwan some years ago, that I wanted to go to Beijing, and we were having a fight with mainland China at the time, and I wasn't able to get a visa and couldn't go. But they were inviting people to come to watch surgical procedures that were being performed with the help of acupuncture and Mozart. No anesthesia. I read about this, and I thought, can that really be true? And because, of course, acupuncture is 8,000 years old and has worked all that time, so it must work now. But to have a surgical procedure using music and this technique, I really wanted to see that, and I wasn't able to go. But music does have power. There was powers that are healing. I know that this is true. There was a time when Zell Milner, who's sort of made me angry with him lately, but when he was governor of Georgia, because he understood that music was so important, do you know that there was a time in Georgia when every single child that was born went home from hospital with a CD of Mozart? And the parents were encouraged to please play this for the child daily. And those children have been shown to be somehow less aggressive. They are somehow more tender. They are somehow nicer to one another. I'm so sorry that it seems the experiment has stopped. But what a wonderful idea, and what a thing for a politician to come up with. And I wish that we could get back to that.
What kind of music? What are some of the songs or orchestral pieces that you listen to for healing?
I listen to a great deal of solo piano music. Because it is my job, I don't listen to a great deal of solo singing. I would tend towards listening to the St. Matthew Passion, the St. John Passion, the Bach B minor Mass for comfort. And for just calming down from a long voyage or something and just getting home I listen to a lot of Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. It works for me.
You know, Thelonious Monk said one of my other favorite quotes, and maybe you would can respond, and how maybe even with some time in your life that this has been the case. Says Thelonious Monk said, "The cats I like are the cats who take chances."
Oh yes, those are the cats I like too.
What's the biggest chance you think you've taken so far? What's the biggest leap?
I don't know. I like taking chances, so I sort of live at the edge quite a lot. Working with a choreographer of the esteem and talent of Bill T. Jones, for instance, was a great challenge and a tremendous learning experience with great joy at the end. But I also have sung both roles in Les Troyens of Berlioz on the same evening, Cassandra and Dido, so I get to die twice. And lately, I've been doing 2 one-person operas, and to my knowledge, I don't know that anyone else has been fool enough to do that. But I sing Schoenberg's Erwartung, and then after an interval, I sing La Voix Humaine of Poulenc. And it's all about the two operas treat women and the way we love and the way we respond to being left in 2 completely different ways.
Well, this is a little bit of a takeoff on something we were talking about last night. You mm-hmm. were there with Felicia.
Yeah.
Is, you know, a male rendering mm-hmm. of a woman.
Oh, yes.
From being inside of those characters in yes. the environment and in Erwartung. What did you think about those ideas of a woman?
Well, now, let's go back to Erwartung of Schoenberg. The libretto was written by Marie Pappenheim. And she had studied medicine and was really rather new at writing at the time that she and Schoenberg had this collaboration. And I had the privilege of going to USC, to the Schoenberg Institute, to look at the letters, the correspondence between the two of them. And it was simply amazing, because even though she was much younger and certainly much less well-known than Arnold Schoenberg, when she sent him a page of text, she would write in the margin what she thought should happen musically and theatrically. I mean, what courage. And I found that to be just illuminating, because he was very obedient and followed very much of what she suggested. And I just find that fantastic. But Jean Cocteau, the writer of the poem for La Voix Humaine, which is also a play, as you know, it's not just an opera, only an opera. Jean Cocteau was so involved with the life of Paris at that time that I am not a bit surprised that his close friendship with people like Edith Piaf and Yvon Printemps and everybody else that was sort of singing cabaret in Paris at that time, I'm not surprised that he was able to wear the mantle of a woman in La Voix Humaine, because he had the acquaintanceship of extremely strong women in his life. It happened that when Jean Cocteau was told that Edith Piaf had died, he had a heart attack. Mm. That's how much she meant to him, and that's how much I would say that she influenced his understanding of a woman and her heart.
What have you learned about your own state of being a woman by singing those 2 operas?
Erwartung draws a lot of its thought from the imaginings and theories of Sigmund Freud, So one can play the woman, and it's, there's only this person in the opera. There's no other character. There are several ways that one can play this character. You can either play the character as though you're having a dream about the fact that the person who has chosen and promised to love you has left and has therefore been somehow mysteriously killed, or you can play this as something that is happening in the moment. And because you have found out that he has been, as we would say, untrue, that you actually commit the murder yourself. And the music is so amazing. I have a little bit of that. Sure, it's difficult to play a little bit of Erwartung, though.
Okay, whatever. It,
because what it's so, you know. It is interesting to go into that kind of mindset. And I, most of the time, play the character as being responsible for everything that happens to this man, rather than having it be some sort of dream that she's having. And then when I'm faced with the woman, the character in Cocteau's La Voix Humaine, I don't play her. I've never felt that she was in any way a victim. In the course of this telephone conversation, it all takes place on a telephone with the man on the other end, and he's pretending that everything is all right and he loves her and everything is lovely, when actually he's somewhere else having a wonderful time, having no intention of coming to see her that evening. And I have decided that she chooses not to go on living. Very much in the way that Virgil's Dido in the fourth book of the Aeneid chooses not to go on living. The loss is just too great and too painful.
So it sounds like your experiences with these characters are then, as you interpret them, also telling you something about your own sense of agency, your own ability to make a choice.
Oh, yes.
Not to be a victim.
Not to be a victim, absolutely not. There are many times when one could throw up one's hands and say, oh gosh, there's nothing I can do about that. I just don't feel that way about anything. I don't feel that way about the Supreme Court decision last week. I'm not going to throw up my hands and say there's nothing to do. There's lots to do.
Well, for one thing, that doesn't surprise me at all, because I think you've also lived a life of extraordinary excellence, but that achievement of that excellence has not meant that you have cut yourself off from the rest of the world.
No.
That you're very much of the world.
Yes.
And that's certainly something that I would like to visit, but maybe we could hear some music.
Yes.
Would you like to hear something? What should we hear first?
What shall we hear first? Let's listen to, I think, the first track, which is Du bist der Lenz. And what it actually means is you are the light that has come into my life. This is Sieglinde from Die Walküre of Wagner. And this is an aria that I learned when I was... And Sieglinde is very much a pivotal character in the Ring cycle of Wagner, because were it not for Sieglinde, we wouldn't have Siegfried in the next opera and Brunhilde sort of marrying him and all of that in the next opera in Götterdämmerung. And it is a beautiful, beautiful aria, I feel. And at the time that I sang it first in New York, when I was just beginning my performance life, I sang it in an orchestral concert. And at that time, somebody wrote, oh gee, wouldn't it be nice if she sang the whole role sometime? And it is kind of amazing to me still that I began my professional life in a role of Wagner, an African-American singing a Wagnerian heroine in Germany. And that was Elisabeth in Tannhäuser. And that I'm somewhat distressed that I'm still the only African-American to sing this role. Still the only African-American to sing Elsa in Lohengrin, or Kundry in Parsifal, or Isolde, or Sieglinde, the music we're going to hear now. When I first started singing this particular opera in New York, the older ones were quite young. I mean, 12 years makes a lot of difference, doesn't it, sort of in the age of a child. And one of them, Joseph, I was explaining the opera and sort of trying to tread very carefully about this brother and sister falling in love and so on. And I wasn't quite sure how to explain that so that I wouldn't have 10-year-olds with eyes this big saying, what? And I was talking about the opera to them because, of course, they were coming to a performance. And Joseph said to me, well, it's all right that they fell in love. They didn't know they were brother and sister at the time. And so that made it easy for me to carry on with the story. I just wanted to share that little bit of information with you.
Let's hear one more.
Shall we hear one more? We will listen then to Dido's Lament from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. Now, this opera was originally written for the Chelsea Girls' School, and the first performance would have been about 1689, I believe. I hope that's right. And because I mentioned before about the fourth book of the Aeneid, this was, Dido Aeneas was changed slightly. The story was given a different turn and a twist by Nahum Tate, who wrote the libretto for this particular rendition of Dido and Aeneas. And it certainly is probably one of the best loved arias in English in the operatic literature. And until this time, of course, opera started in Italy, and so most of what one heard in the opera house was in Italian. And so when this opera came along and was, you know, it was in a Chelsea girls' school and wasn't sort of really sort of didn't pay a lot of attention to it. And it wasn't until the following year, when it was produced professionally, that the people of England and the rest of the world, particularly Europe, realized that they had a masterpiece on their hands. And this aria, "When I am laid in earth, may my wrongs be forgotten," is an aria that I think I have sung more times than I can count. Thy hand, Belinda. Thank you.
we should take a couple of questions and then come back with more music and everything else. Because I know people have things they want to know. Yes, why not? Oh, we actually have cards, but we'll take your question.
No, we'll take your question, please.
We'll take your question.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
What was it?
Yes. Well, I think I was the only person in the world who did not know that the stock market had crashed.
Well, I gave a birthday party that day.
Yeah.
And you performed at a concert for the statue of Duke Ellington.
Absolutely.
And I was the first donor. Bobby Short grabbed me early.
Oh, my.
And I would like you to have comment on the influence of Bobby Short and Duke Ellington.
Oh, my dear. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for what you did to make it possible to have the Duke Ellington statue in Central Park. It's really true that I'd been in rehearsal all day, and I had the faintest idea what had happened financially, not the faintest. And Bobby Short, of course, was one of my dearest friends, and we lost him earlier this year. This is really last year. It's not easy to speak about that. But he felt so strongly that the influence and the legacy of Duke Ellington required celebration, that he felt that having this statue was the least that we could do for Duke Ellington. If you are familiar with his music at all, you would agree, I think, with me, that what he was able to do orchestrally, most particularly, has influenced everything that has happened in jazz since then. And I sing his music a great deal and am privileged and happy to do so. And I love being questioned about it. Well, why do you do this and perhaps not something else? But I think that we need to remember always how other things have come into being. There could not have been a Miles Davis if he hadn't sort of been able to hear and listen and talk to the master before becoming a master himself. And so I'm very glad to know you, and I thank you very much for what you did to make it possible for those of us sort of wandering through Central Park to remember this master. I remember him every day of my life.
And who are some of the influences on your mastery?
Everybody.
Who's your Duke Ellington?
My Duke Ellington. You know, I find, as I said to some of the students yesterday, I find inspiration in so many places that it is hard to limit that inspiration to musicians. I find inspiration in the legacy of Hank Aaron. I find inspiration in knowing what those African-American singers and other musicians that went before me, what they, as I said before, endured simply in order to be able to present their talent and their artistry to the world. All of this is my Duke Ellington. When I was sitting it's 2007, about 9 years ago, having decided that I talked about it, and now I was going to do it, the sacred music of Duke Ellington, about which few of you, I think, or know, I took the three sacred music concerts that he composed near the end of his life, and I just sat there at my desk saying, now I can't do it all, but I need to create one concert from all of this music. And I really felt guided in choosing the pieces that have now become a production that I call Sacred Ellington, which uses Margie Gillis as a dancer. It's a jazz combo, a string quartet, a jazz ensemble and a gospel choir and me. And this music is something that really, whenever we've had an opportunity to present it, people, first of all, are surprised that they're familiar with the footprint, that they're familiar with the architecture, they're familiar with the rhythms and the harmonies, because they don't know these particular songs of Duke Ellington. But it takes you perhaps 30 seconds to realize that this is the music of Duke Ellington.
It's an extraordinary evening.
Oh, you're very kind to say so, but I look forward to being able to present this in the States quite soon.
I mean, you have sung also, you know, so much European music.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the mastery there that has influenced your own development and your extraordinary discipline?
Well, we have to remember that when I first started singing, when I called myself a baby singer, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Elisabeth Schwarzkopf and Christa Ludwig and Hermann Prey and Gerard Souzé, all of these people were making fabulous careers singing songs. And I spent a great deal of time sitting and listening to them, and I had the good fortune of being able to start my professional life in Europe, so it wasn't difficult to hear them and to get on the train with a second or third class ticket and go from Munich to Frankfurt to hear a performance of Fischer-Dieskau and get on another train the next day and go and to hear Schwarzkopf singing in Vienna. So I learned a great deal about the profession, and I also learned a great deal about what it meant to stand in front of an audience and present a text. And even though most of the people that I mentioned, other than Gerard Souzé, who did a lot of his performances, of course, in French, I also learned about using this wonderful German language, in which, thank goodness, I am fluent and completely comfortable. And completely comfortable because I was invited. The whole thing is such a nonsense, and it is a fairy tale, but I promise you, it's the truth. I sang at an audition in New York City, and J. Ralph Corbett, an industrialist from Cincinnati, Ohio, his wife was a singer, and she was very interested in the fact that American singers were forced to go to Europe and to travel around to various opera houses auditioning. And she had the wonderful idea of inviting all of those opera directors to come to New York so that those of us who were at a point where we might have been ready for a serious audition would go to New York and sing for them. They were held captive in Town Hall by J. Ralph Corbett and his wife. And it is a nonsense, but it is absolutely true. I sang the second aria from Tannhäuser, Elisabeth, and the director of the largest opera house in Germany, in Berlin, Egon Zellfelner, came to me afterwards and said, you've sung the most difficult aria for Elisabeth in the opera. I'm sure that you can sing the other one. So therefore, I would like to invite you to come to my opera house to sing the whole opera. Oof. Do you know the whole opera? And I said, well, no, but I could learn it in a couple of weeks. And he said, no, it doesn't need to be quite as quickly as that. This was in May of a year. And I had my first performance in a professional opera on a professional stage in Berlin, singing this opera. But before I went to Berlin, I went to Duke University and I studied German for 4.5 months. It never occurred to me that I was going to go to Germany and not be able to speak to my colleagues.
But you also, as you said the other day, you've said a number of times, you do not sing in a language that you do not speak.
No, I don't. So there's wonderful, wonderful music in Russian that I really would adore to sing. I don't speak Russian, so therefore I don't sing these songs.
You know, when you were talking about taking the train to Munich and so forth,
mm-hmm.
then in Berlin, you were there when the wall was up.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And so you had to go from west to east, right?
Yes,
and
that absolutely.
Could have been an ordeal, and it was once, yes?
Well, I spent a great deal of time. I was, you know, sort of, I just got my degree from the University of Michigan. I couldn't have been more green. But I spent a great deal of time going from West Berlin, where I worked and lived, to East Berlin, because there were museums and orchestras and opera houses there that I wanted to visit and come to know. And there was also an incredible stage director by the name of Felsenstein. And he would take an opera and work with the singers for 3 months before the opera production was actually put on stage. The bad part of that was that he insisted that singers would sing full out at every rehearsal, which meant by the time the opera production was actually on stage, few of the singers had really any voice left. But the acting, the concentration on the interrelationships among the characters was something that simply doesn't happen in opera today in the West, and it is a great shame. If you can believe it, we rehearse for 3 weeks in a studio, 1 week on the stage, and we're up. No out-of-town trials. It's unbelievable. But of course, it has to do with economics. But I spent a great deal of time going back and forth through Checkpoint Charlie with my American passport that was really meant to be quite simple. And I got to know, of course, a few people that became very close friends, and they would walk with me in the Friedrichstrasse as far as they could go. And it was literally across the road, I mean, the next place. It wasn't even across a bridge or a river. It was walking across the road, mm-hmm. the street, in the middle of the street. And they would go with me as far as they could go, and then we would kiss and say goodbye, and I would walk across the road to West Berlin. And somehow the guards decided that they needed to teach me a lesson one night. And one could only have a day visa, which meant that one could go to East Berlin, but you needed to be back in West Berlin by midnight. And I was always obedient. I wasn't trying to get myself into any trouble. And one night I arrived and was with a group of students as well as the people that I'd come to know there. And we'd been to some performance or the other. And it was past 11:50, and I knew that I needed to walk across the road. And the East German guards decided that they would teach me a lesson. So they took my passport. I'm still on the East German side now. They took my passport and took me into a room where there were no lights, and they closed and locked the door. Now, I didn't know whether they were ever going to come back or whether they were coming back in 10 minutes or what the story was going to be. They actually left me there until 2:30 in the morning. Now, my friends that were waiting for me in West Berlin, of course, had no idea what was going on. And honestly, neither did I. And at about 2:30, the guards came and opened the door and gave me my passport and said, Sie können jetzt gehen, you can go now. No explanation as to why I was kept or for what reason. And of course, I was trembling, thinking, what am I going to say to the people in West Berlin when I walk across the road as to why I'm late? And when I walked across the road and was beginning a story to the West Berlin guards, they said, don't worry about it. Take the train home. Be good.
Well, you know, you told us the other day, me and Kitty, and I know we don't have the piece of music, but speaking of the German language, you told us about when the wall came down, and you had the opportunity to hear a German group of artists sing Fidelio, and particularly how they sang the word Freihof, is that the
Freiheit.
Word? Freiheit. Freedom.
Freedom.
Talk about that.
It was amazing. 2 weeks after the Berlin Wall came down, the irony was that we were recording Beethoven's only opera, and the subject, of course, is political. I had spent a lot of time, and have spent, and still do, a lot of time in what used to be the Eastern Bloc, behind the Iron Curtain and all of that, where Time Magazine, Newsweek, Life, none of that could be brought into that part of the world because it was considered, I don't know what, subversive. And returning to East Germany, we recorded in Dresden, returning to East Germany 2 weeks after the wall had come down, there were all these international newspapers all over the place. People were so pleased to be free. They were so ecstatic to be able to take the Frankfurter Allgemeine, the Frankfurt newspaper, and to read it openly, or to have copies of Time Magazine or Newsweek. And they were kind of spread all over the place to prove we're free now, we can do what we like. And I'm sorry that we don't have the music, but I didn't have time to find it on the disc and the numbers were not listed. But in the choral section where they sing the word Freiheit, I tell you, it practically blew me off the stage when the chorus got to that part of their presentation. And I was meant to sing shortly after that, and I just had to hold up my hand and say, I need a moment, I can't go on. This is just too much. And I went and we had a little week together and with the chorus, and I said, I know what this means to you. I want you to know it means a great deal to me too.
And you see, so much of your singing has that awareness of what a word means and the power of a word. The word
Absolutely.
Can blow somebody off the stage or open your heart or break your heart. And think of it, if they had not had the experience of the wall coming down, they wouldn't understand the word the same way.
They wouldn't have understood the word in the same way. You're absolutely right.
I think that's the justification to think about how it's important now to ask artists not only to stay inside of the safety of their studios, but to be in this world.
Oh, absolutely.
So that they can sing about something.
Absolutely.
And you've been singing about something. Even when you were singing, you know, Jesus Loves Me, you know, you were singing, you were in the South, you know, in a segregated society.
Yes.
And you were singing to Mrs. Hubert, you were singing about something.
Yes, absolutely.
It wasn't just the song. Maybe
no.
you were trying to heal her as an old woman.
Yes. She was my friend. And I can't stress enough, as I said to the students yesterday, the importance of knowing every word that you're singing. Don't dare to stand up in front of an audience and sing words that you sort of know what they mean or you have read an interesting translation of what it is you're singing. Just don't do that. Don't sing phonetically. You can get away with it, but please don't do it. It's too important.
Tell about the violinist in This Is the Last Piece of Music, because it's along those lines, the violinist who came to you in getting prepared for the four last songs. And tell us what the song means that we're going to hear now.
One of the many joys of working with really great orchestras is learning from them. Now, on this occasion, when we were recording the four last songs, which, in spite of the fact that we have had people in charge of classical recording, certainly over the last 10 years or so, who could not have been less interested in classical recordings, this recording survives and has been re-released twice already. At the time that we were recording this wonderful music, the gentleman that was the concertmeister, that's mean the first violinist in the orchestra, the leader of the orchestra, was playing with the orchestra for the very last time. And he has a very important solo in the third song of the four last songs of Strauss, which is called Beim Schlafen gehen, and it means going to sleep, but the eternal sleep. And this man had been in the orchestra for more than 40 years. Yet because of his respect for the music and his respect for Strauss and the fact that these notes were going to be his last notes with the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, he came to my dressing room and tapped very quietly, and I said, "Who?" as I always do. And he
said,
"That
used to be you who?"
Yes, that would be you who otherwise. And and he said, "Darf ich reinkommen? May I come in?" And I said, "But of course." And he said, "I would like you to listen to what I have to play with you today to see if it's all right with you." And I said, "See if it's all right with me? How very kind of you." And this is what he played. Beim Schlafen gehen, Richard Strauss, Four Last Songs. And my wings unfettered go to the beyond. My soul is completely free. Live a thousand times longer than I've lived on earth. Yeah.
somebody who nonetheless believes what Lena Horne said is right, which is every woman needs a little bit of
Tina Turner in her.
Let me take the privilege as we close here, calling your attention to the fact that the audio equipment, which you listened to the reproduction of this magical voice, happened to be Harmon JBL. Listen, I am persuaded that when we have a similar gathering at next year's Ideas Festival, this gathering will be 4 times larger than it is, and I am determined that the percentage of males be 4 times higher than it is.
Oh no.
Among, among us this afternoon is a very special male, and I simply want to acknowledge his presence, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Gioia. Over here.
Thank you.
Let me tell you that in my view, this is the one dancing star of the administration. He has taken an impoverished, budget-shy national endowment, enriched it, proselytized the arts, all the arts, vigorously, actively, everywhere in the country. And I am absolutely determined that when he finishes this task, we're going to get him deeply involved in our arts program at the Aspen Institute. Let me finish by commenting that Galileo told us that mathematics was the vocabulary God used when writing the universe. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt at all that she was listening to Jesse Norman singing Mozart, conducted by Anna Deavere Smith. Thank you all very much.
We can't leave without acknowledging that there is a Jesse Norman School for the Arts in Augusta, Georgia.
Thank you.